Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The Islamic State in Iraq and Syria is celebrating its one-year anniversary today. On June 29, 2014, the group declared itself a caliphate with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi as its leader. In the lead-up to this grim moment, ISIS carried out a horrific massacre in the Syrian border town of Kobani last Thursday. The Kurdish town saw 145 of its residents killed in what is likely to be the second worst massacre ever carried out by ISIS. There were many children, women, and elderly among the killings, which were the results of at least two suicide bomb attacks. Meanwhile, three other incidents around the world are being attributed to ISIS. Late last week, in Tunisia, an armed attack on a beach resulted in at least 38 deaths, and at least half of those deaths were of British nationals. UK Prime Minister David Cameron has now promised a, quote, full-spectrum response to ISIS, calling it a poisonous death cult. In France, a U.S.-run chemical plant was attacked with one person being beheaded and an unsuccessful attempt to blow up the entire plant. And in Kuwait, a mosque was attacked with dozens killed. The U.S. and its allies launched 21 airstrikes aimed at ISIS over the weekend in Syria and Iraq. My guest is Reese Ehrlich. He's a veteran freelance foreign correspondent who's traveled widely across the Middle East and has written a number of books, and one of them being Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence and Empire. And also his latest book is called Inside Syria, The Backstory of the Civil War and What the World Can Expect. Welcome back to the show, Reese.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Kobani, just months ago, successfully repelled a takeover by ISIS. It was the center of Kurdish resistance, and the U.S. made much of this setback for ISIS. What does this new attack mean with these suicide bombings last Thursday? I mean, how did it happen? How does ISIS have a foothold in this place once again?
Well, it doesn't really have any ability to reoccupy Kobani, but they were able to send in suicide bombers and truck bombers disguised as Peshmerga, disguised as Free Syrian Army, and caused a great deal of damage. And it was certainly a setback. But I think looking at it in a wider context, the Kurdish and Free Syrian Army forces were able to take a town right along the Kurdish-Syrian and Turkish border. And that was enabled the potential of cutting off supply lines to the ISIS forces not far away in Raqqa. So this, and seen in a wider context, they're striking back in an effort to keep their supply lines open all the way into central Syria.
Let's talk about the fact that this particular incident and series of incidents on Thursday may have been enabled by Turkey. This is how the New York Times described what happened. Islamic State fighters disguised in the uniforms of Kurdish militiamen had sneaked into the town at dawn when few people were awake. Then a large truck bomb exploded at the town's border crossing with Turkey, setting off clashes between the Islamic State militants and local Kurdish forces. They entered the neighborhoods and started killing civilians on their way, said Baran Mesko, a Kurdish activist in Kobani. And he said about 100 Islamic State fighters disguised as locals had taken up positions in Kobani. Now, in the past year, Turkey has had a complicated relationship with ISIS, and many have accused it of essentially enabling ISIS fighters to get in through its border. Do you think that's possibly what happened?
Well, there's no no question that historically Turkey has allowed extremist forces to use its to transit through Turkey into Syria. And they figured that they were backing whoever could seem to make some progress against the Assad government, and therefore had no problem backing financially and militarily these extremist groups. The current thinking is that the Turks consider the Kurdish fighters of the PYD, who are affiliated with the Turkish PKK, to be more dangerous than the ISIS. And so the people who follow that view suspect that the Turks have allowed ISIS to use Turkish territory to come in, to cross the border, to bring in arms and so on, because above all else, the Turks do not want to see a PKK enclave along the Syrian-Turkish border. The PKK, of course, being the Kurdistan Workers' Party, a group in Turkey that has been fighting for autonomy and is labeled as a terrorist group, although in fact they're not.
And of course, this has been the PKK's fighters have been amongst the most effective resistance to ISIS on the ground. In undermining that, effectively, Turkey undermines the U.S. war on ISIS as well, doesn't it?
Exactly. And it highlights the futility of the U.S. bombing effort in Syria and Iraq, because basically it has very few, if any, allies on the ground, with the exception of the Kurds. And the dispute goes back to August of last year, when the U.S. decided that the Islamic State was the main enemy in Syria. The Turks, the Saudis, and all the rebel groups basically believe that Assad is the main enemy. And that difference has led to huge practical differences on the ground.
And of course, lest we focus on the U.S. war as being anything other than a disaster, let's talk about the fact that the U.S. has, over the past year, essentially gone back into Iraq in terms of now fighting an air war, which has expanded into Syria. Over the weekend, I mentioned 21 targets were hit, or 21 airstrikes, rather, hit a number of targets. Not only is the U.S. bombing necessary, you know, just seeming to be futile in this past year, isn't it also fueling ISIS? Doesn't it make things worse? Don't the past decades of U.S. wars in the region prove that this is just not an option or an approach that ever works?
Well, you notice that.
I mean, it seems glaringly obvious to everybody.
Yeah, everyone except in Washington. I just came back this weekend from speaking in Washington, D.C., and there's this amazing bubble in the capital of the debate is between traditional interventionists and humanitarian interventionists. But the idea that the U.S. shouldn't intervene at all is completely strange back there. But of course, the rest of the world recognizes that. I was in northern Iraq and the Kurdish region in August of last year when the bombing started. And I wrote at that time that the U.S. had no allies on the ground to fight door to door as would be necessary to retake territory and cities. And the bombing would not accomplish the goals. And sure enough, that's been the case. And it's been going on almost a year now. And the U.S. continues to bomb. And the Islamic State has become transformed from a very evil, very dangerous group to the people of Syria and Iraq to a very evil, very dangerous group of danger to the whole world. And it's a direct result of the U.S. bombing and all the publicity that they've given them.
Now, let's talk about the couple of other attacks that took place last week. And this is certainly consistent with what ISIS already announced, that they announced essentially a month of disaster for non-Muslims during the holy month of Ramadan that, you know, Muslims around the world celebrate and commemorate with a traditional month of fasting. In Tunisia, whose Arab Spring Revolution was supposed to be the most successful of all the various revolutions, 38 people at least were killed in a primarily tourist area on a beach. And I understand there were either one or multiple gunmen wielding a Kalashnikov in the resort town of Sousse. How could this have happened? And why do you think ISIS attacked Turkey? And of course, ISIS has killed Tunisians in gruesome ways before, but this time it went after tourists.
Yeah. I think, first of all, it's important to note that this is not an example of a coordinated a command and control situation where people sitting in Raqqa, Syria, can issue orders around the world to carry out these attacks. These are, a general call is made, and then individuals or small groups in various places take it upon themselves to carry out these horrific attacks. It's similar to what's happened in the United States at various times with individuals carrying out what they consider to be attacks, but it's not under the command and control of ISIS. You're quite correct, and I've been in Tunisia. It is, of all the Arab Spring uprisings, it has the most stable. The left is a significant force in the politics of the country through the trade unions, through the student movement, and through the parliament. But there's always been a huge danger from the extremists of political Islam. And this most recent attack is an example of that. It wasn't but a few months ago there was an attack on a museum there. And as evil as this is, there is a plan behind it, which is they want to tourism is a major force for the economy in Tunisia. If they can discourage tourists from coming, It will hurt the economy. It will cause instability, and they hope allowing them to come to power. But as an actual political force, these extremist groups have very little support in Tunisia.
And then there's the Kuwait attack, 27 people killed when a Shiite mosque was bombed in Kuwait. And this, of course, even though it is a Gulf country, is a very prominent ally of the United States and has been. It's a country that ISIS, as far as I know, has not been able to carry out this kind of an attack in before. How unprecedented is the ISIS attack on Kuwait?
Well, keep in mind that these are all soft targets. That is, they weren't bombing police stations or military operations or the U.S. bases or some, military targets. You go after a mosque where people are not armed, where there's no guards and so on. And of course, for people who claim to be upholding political Islam, who are they murdering? Fellow Muslims. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous.
Of course, to the Sunni ISIS, the ISIS group that claims that they are Sunni supremacists, Shiites, they don't even consider Shiites Muslims, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So anybody who doesn't agree with them in terms of religion or politics is an enemy and therefore subject to bombing. But what the impact of this is to alienate people, Muslims in general around the world, as a result of these tactics.
Now, let's talk about the fact that there was an incident in France where a U.S.-run chemical plant was attacked. It's not clear if ISIS was behind this. Of course, I'm sure it's happy to take credit for anything it possibly can. There was an employee of a delivery truck caught trying to blow up the plant, and a horrifically gruesome crime. The head and the body of his boss found in the truck he was driving, along with flags that looked like ISIS flags. What do you make of this? And of course, ISIS has made it very clear that it wants to bring these attacks to Western shores. And France has already, had the Charlie Hebdo attacks earlier this year, which ISIS also claimed credit for.
Yeah, I think we have to wait to see exactly more details on that attack. In the U.S., if a disgruntled worker attacks a post office or something like that, then it's a deranged individual, whereas in these situations is automatically assumed it must be a crazy Muslim or something. So we simply
don't
know.
Or part of some organized political strategy.
If you're Muslim, then you must be part of some terrorist international organization. Well, we simply don't know at this point, and hopefully we'll find out. But it is true that there are young, alienated immigrants from North Africa, from countries like Algeria and Morocco and Tunisia and others in France, who are alienated, who are stuck in poverty, and some of them turn to these extremist groups as an alternative.
Now, I want to bring up David Cameron because he's been quite vocal, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, who, in response to the attack in Tunisia, where a number of Britons were killed, 15, possibly 30 of those killed were British citizens. He has talked about striking back with a full spectrum response against ISIS. But this is exactly what ISIS wants. In killing these British civilians, tourists essentially, and targeting the West, it wants to draw the West in. And Cameron is very much embracing the bait. And this is also a sort of a dilemma for press, for those of us in the media covering these issues. On the one hand, ISIS desperately wants attention, and their dramatic and gruesome propaganda is designed to elicit disgust and anger. On the other hand, we can't ignore it. How do you view, as a journalist, Reese, these responses and what ISIS is trying to do, and the way in which it's trying to bait the world, basically?
Well, keep in mind that media coverage these days doesn't have the same impact it might have some years ago, because ISIS very effectively uses Facebook and other social media to its advantage, which of course has nothing to do with the mainstream media coverage or even Pacifica type coverage. So I think as journalists, we have to cover what's going on. And keep in mind that the vast majority of Muslims around the world, not to mention everyone else, abhors these kinds of attacks. But to solve the problem, the military attacks are not going to do it alone. You have to undercut them politically. The British, U.S. and other countries have to change their policies, stop the kind of military attacks, stop unquestioned support for Israel. There's a whole list of things that would undercut these groups politically and therefore lay the basis for dealing a death blow militarily.
And speaking of Israel, the latest Freedom Flotilla to Gaza was just stopped by Israel, and there have been no casualties so far. And Israel has traditionally, or in the past, attacked them violently, attacked such ships that have been trying to break the siege on Gaza violently. Finally, as ISIS seems to have recovered from its minor setbacks over the past few months, and as it enters its second year as a caliphate, self-declared caliphate, what do you foresee for this summer?
Well, in the short run, it's going to be a lot of continued fighting and a very difficult situation. The bombing by the U.S., Britain, and others is not having the impact that they claimed it would, but they're going to continue doing it, which means more civilians continue to die. The Islamic State will have some setbacks. It will have some victories. I don't think there will be a decisive battle. In the medium run, I'm a bit more optimistic because I think there can be a political settlement both in Iraq and Syria. But the short run, there's going to be a lot more fighting and a lot more death.
Well, Reese Ehrlich, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and I'm sure we'll have you back on the show in the future.
Always my pleasure.
My guest, Reese Ehrlich, is a veteran foreign correspondent, and we've been talking about the one-year anniversary of ISIS. He's written a number of books, including Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. And his latest book is called Inside Syria, The Backstory of the Civil War and What the World Can Expect. And a brief announcement, by the way, for our Southern California audience. Exactly a week from tomorrow, Max Blumenthal will be coming to Southern California to present his latest book, The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. It's an event organized by Uprising. I'll be interviewing Max on stage, and you can get tickets to this event at kpfk.org. The funds that we raise from this event will help keep the TV production of Uprising financially solvent. And so we really hope that you come. It's going to be a wonderful event. Poet Shole Wolpe will also be performing. Again, that is next Tuesday, July 7th. At the First Congregational Church in downtown Los Angeles, you can get tickets at kpfk.org. Max is also going to be speaking this week for our KPFA audience, July 1st, at also the First Congregational Church. And you can find out more about that event if you are in the Bay Area at kpfa.org. This is Uprising. We'll be right back.